a win because the indigenous population is still there, is surviving, and is, continues to resist.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting for me is I see the increase in the confidence in the Palestinians, especially in the West Bank, where in themselves and their capabilities. Definitely after the series of guerrilla operations that we saw hitting what Israel considers as its own security fortress inside its colonial settlers' capital, it is raising concerns inside the Israeli cabinet, which why we saw them doing some sort of a limited incursion into the Jenin camp recently, and it was bad, a result bad for them. But will the occupation maybe resort to a similar incursion to the West Bank, maybe in his own mind, to prevent any further uprising of the Palestinian natives in the West Bank?
It's a good question, because it shows this dilemma of the Zionist entity, where on the one hand, it cannot survive without violence. If the Zionist entity would not be oppressing and killing Palestinians and dispossessing them and seizing their land, it would not exist, because the entire idea of the Zionist entity as such is based on these apartheid structures that necessitate violence. So any lack of violence from the side of the Zionist regime would effectively lead to the dismantling of the Zionist regime. Now, at the same time, of course, the Zionist regime is, of course, also on alert of any potential retaliations from Palestinians. And I think the situation that we've seen last year in May 2021, where there was a similar situation as today during the holy month of Ramadan, and in which the Palestinian resistance has showed their new capabilities of targeting and retaliating by targeting colonies within the 1948 territories. So the Zionist entity is confronted with this dilemma, and effectively this is also where potential ways towards liberation lie, because any cease of violence would lead to the destruction of the apartheid regime, because it can only uphold itself on these injustices and the actual physical violence. But this cannot happen without reactions from the indigenous people. I'd also just like to add that the mere fact that indigenous people exist and basically just remain on their land is the major threat to the colonial regime. And by viewing the actual situation from that perspective, I think really reveals once more the fragility of the Zionist regime.
Well, Palestinians live daily through obstruction at the level of the political action, whether it is from the Ramallah Authority or from the normalization, the wave of normalization that has hit the region of West Asia, maybe as well in the different stages of confrontation with the Zionist entity. Now, a feeling of necessity to take their fate into their own hands has culminated within the Palestinian communities. But is it fair to suggest that the Palestinians be left to their own fate? I mean, even though with their legendary resistance operation, what I mean here, if there is a comprehensive revolution to be started in Palestine, what will be the role of the surrounding of Palestine? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to some extent, I think Palestinians have been, there have been attempts internationally to isolate Palestinians, to isolate their struggle, especially, of course, not only by the Israeli regime, but maybe to a larger extent, even more so by its backers, the European Union, United States, and what is generally referred to as the so-called international community, in which there have been attempts rhetorically to portray the Palestinian cause as a diplomatic conflict, allegedly, or as an isolated incident. And however, of course, it is a transnational issue, and Palestinians have been continuing to resist. There have been uprisings. We've seen different episodes of different intifadas in which Palestinians went to the streets and continued to really dismantle those colonial structures, to which, as a reaction, the Zionist regime had to come up time and time again with new and more sophisticated forms of control and containment. So Palestinians have continued to resist and continue to do so, and doing so posed a major challenge to the existence of the Zionist enemy. Now, at the same time, of course, the mere fact that the Zionist entity is still existing in its forms is mostly due to the foreign backing that it receives from the United States and European Union in particular, and then recently, of course, more diplomatically from Arab regimes in the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And of course, if that support were to be withdrawn, a situation would be different. But even within this so-called international community, in this system that is so flawed, there is still the Palestinian right to armed resistance, as the UN resolutions that guarantee people under occupation the right to resist and to use any forms or any means at their disposal against the foreign occupation. And another point I would like to address is the fact that the Zionist occupation colonization has been transnational in its core. It has targeted mm-hmm. Syria, it has targeted Lebanon, it has targeted populations outside of historic Palestine. And so as such, the response and the resistance against the colonial regime has been a transnational one all along.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't really seem going very well for the Zionist entity at the moment. We'll have to wait and see what happens next. I want to thank you very much, Daniel Yagic, academic and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very crucial matter at the time being. Please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking how Saudi Arabia has no way to win that war in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
All indicators lead to pessimism about the persistence of the UN-sponsored humanitarian truce in Yemen after a third of the period has passed without any significant military and humanitarian progress amid erosion of Sana'a's confidence in the possibility of the coalition of aggression and the United Nations fulfilling their obligations. Commenting on the ongoing war in Yemen, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei criticized Saudi Arabia's intervention in Yemen, asking Saudi Arabia to cease its aggression and involvement in Yemen, emphasizing that this comment comes out of goodwill towards the Gulf Kingdom. No possibility of Saudi victory in Yemen in this following report.
As Saudi Arabia continues to play a key role in influencing neighboring Yemen's political future, the kingdom's main regional rival, Iran, has maintained its place on the other side of the equation in support of the Yemeni people in the face of the Saudi war machine. Leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, criticized Saudi Arabia's constant aggression on Yemen during a Ramadan ceremony in Tehran. Sayyid Khamenei asked Saudi Arabia to cease its aggression on Yemen, saying he made the comments out of goodwill towards the kingdom. "I have a word for the Saudis, and I give this counsel out of goodwill for them. Why are you continuing a war you're certain you won't win? Find a way out of this war." Sayyid Khamenei then asked, "Is there even a possibility that the Saudis would win the war in Yemen?" "There's no possibility. With the endeavors, initiative, and courage of the Yemeni people and leaders, there's no possibility of you winning." "If the truce is truly implemented," Khamenei added, "it can be extended and the people of Yemen can prevail through the efforts, bravery, and initiative of themselves and their leaders." Sayyid Khamenei's remarks follow ongoing talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia. About a year ago, the two sides began a dialogue in Baghdad aimed at reducing tensions. It's not a secret that the two countries have a variety of disagreements, and not just on Yemen. Saudi Arabia also vocally opposes Iran's nuclear development, as well as the Islamic Republic's support of the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah. Iran is against the repression of Shia Muslims in Saudi Arabia, the absurd Saudi war on Yemen, and the Saudi attempt to normalize ties with the region's main enemy, Israel. The talks made considerable progress last year, according to officials. Last October, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the deliberations had advanced a good distance. On April 25th, Iran said that the latest round of talks with Saudi Arabia was positive and serious, and voiced hope for further progress soon. The latest talks were reportedly attended by senior officials from the Secretariat of Iran's Supreme National Security Council and the head of the Saudi Intelligence Service, as foreign ministers of the two countries are expected to meet in the near future. In the meantime, Iran's position on an eventual peace process in Yemen has been consistent since the first day of the Saudi war on Yemen. Whether or not the current Iranian-Saudi talks would convince the Saudi side to maintain peace in Yemen is yet to be seen. As Sana'a announced last week that the Saudi-led coalition is halting the peace process and evading its commitments to facilitating travels at Sana'a International Airport and allowing oil derivatives to enter the country by sea.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamid Razab, Deputy Mayor of Tehran for International Affairs and a political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Hamid. Now, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's comments about Saudi Arabia having zero possibility to win the war against Yemen came in the form of a friendly remark while asking the Saudis, and I quote, "I give this counsel out of goodwill. Why are you continuing a war? You're certain you won't win. Just find a way out of this war." Was this a form of an argument against the Saudi logic about this war, or rather a message that the leader is conveying to the regime of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. The point is that this comment is just out of common sense. It's clear that a war that was supposed to be won in 3 weeks and is lasting for several years is not going to be won by the Saudis anymore. So it is just pure common sense and pure reason, actually. So if the Saudis are not reaching that resolve or that argument is something that they are falling about that. No, the point is that what Ayatollah Khamenei said is that this war is not going to be won by any means by the Saudis and all the situations on the ground. Besides, let's just put aside the propaganda machine and the media outcomes, the reality on the ground of the battlefield is showing us that the Yemenis have a good situation in that war, and the Saudis are not going to win anymore. And if it continues anymore, that would be more damage to the Saudis. And Iran does not want an important country in the region to be destroyed anymore, to have more casualties among the citizens, to have more damages to the region, because any damage to the region, any discord in the region, has one winner, and that is the Westerners, the Zionists in the occupied Palestine, and they are winning the war here in between. And the Saudis are just some puppet regime that are serving the interests of those regimes in the West, mm-hmm. and of course in the occupied Palestine. So it is just a reality that was reiterated to the Saudis.
Well, we do know that Iran and Saudi Arabia are conducting talks at the moment, negotiations, let's say. But Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that even though the truce in Yemen is an agreement written on a paper, it is still very good to stop the war, even if for 2 months. And he would love it and he would appreciate it if it continued further, reiterating that the Yemeni people is a patient people, although they are deeply oppressed by this war. Now, if Saudi Arabia decides to continue after the truce ends and they decide to continue further with that war, would that interrupt the ongoing negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Iran sees Yemen as a sovereign country, and the Yemen resistance is a sovereign state, and Iran is not going to interfere in that. Iran is supporting the Houthis and the Yemenis in that war, but it doesn't mean that Iran is going to decide for them or to consider any involvement there in its own politics. So the negotiations, which is based on the goodwill of Iran in good neighborliness and in which Iran is trying to seek some better relationship with another Muslim country in the region, a neighboring country, doesn't have anything to do with other issues in other areas. If the Saudis or other Arab countries are actually adhering to that so-called Abrahamic peace accord with the Zionist regime, and we know that how hostile the Zionists are toward Iran, but Iran is not going to consider that as a part of the negotiation. The point is that Iran is seeing negotiations as a ground to be closer to the countries in the region and to keep them closer and not to push them away to get in line with other countries that are not in the region or other regimes that are actually sowing discord to benefit for their own. So I don't think that Iran is going to decide for the war in Yemen or to want to use it as a bargaining chip in the negotiations with the Saudis. Iran is respecting the Yemenis and is supporting the peace or ceasefire in that region. But it's not that, I don't think that if the ceasefire is actually broken or the Saudis continue the war, Iran would stop the negotiations that it has directly with the Saudis.
Well, it was clear, to be honest with you, from the day the truce was announced that the coalition of aggression had no serious or sincere intentions to enforce it in Yemen as a first step to building confidence, by the way, in order to build up for more peace. But I refuse to believe that the UN truly has no power to oblige the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to adhere to the terms of this truce that it has already committed itself to. Then why are they lagging on this? Why are they allowing the airport to be open and the port to be open for at least the oil derivatives for the people not to suffocate in Yemen?
First of all, I do agree that it was clear actually from day one that the Saudis are not going to adhere to the ceasefire. And they are looking at it just as a breaking point to have less attack from the Yemeni side. It was a resting point for the Saudis actually, and to attack the Yemenis because they know that the Yemenis are going to keep the promise. Regarding the United Nations, it's nothing new that they are very inactive. And let's just remember that for the same Saudis, they paid the UN to remove the Saudi Arabia from the list of the child-killing regimes in just a few years ago. And it was exactly because of the war in Yemen that they were put in that list. So the United Nations is easily bought by money, or by politics, or by, let's say, pressure from some Western countries. So we cannot expect the United Nations to take any considerable and real measures or steps toward keeping that ceasefire, because they don't have the power to, and they don't have the will to interfere in such things. And this inactivity through all these years and decades has made it something, let's say, ceremonial and ceremonial organization, which is incapable of stopping wars anywhere in the world, especially in places like here, in which Saudi Arabians are using their petrodollars to actually buy the organization, international organizations.
Well, it definitely seemed that the upcoming weeks will bring a lot of development to the Saudi war in Yemen, and it remains to be seen how the Yemenis will react to the ongoing aggression. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hamid Reza, Deputy Mayor of Tehran, for international affairs and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this crucial matter. I want to thank you very much for being with us, and happy Eid for you, Eid Fitr Sa'id for you and your families, and Ramadan Mubarak for everyone. May next year be a much peaceful year on all the world, on all the globe, in these holy days that we are passing. Thank you very much, and I'll see you next week on the Middle East Stream.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which, you know, a lot of people ask. This is a question related to history and the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And that question is this. We know that after Imam Ali formally accepted the government after the death of the third caliph Usman, he made the city of Kufa, which is currently in Iraq, the center of his government. So some people ask, why is it that Imam Ali did not make the city of Mecca or the city of Medina, which are, you know, the two most holiest cities in the Islamic world, geographically, why didn't he make them the center of his government? This is a question that we'd like to pose and ask today. By way of passing, we can say that actually and ironically, Imam Ali did make the city of Medina in the beginning of his government the center of his government and the capital of his government. However, due to certain reasons, he decided to change his government and move to Kufa. One of the reasons for this was the fact that in the city of Basra, a rebellion had begun, coordinated by certain individuals who would later become known as the Ashabu Jamal. So in order to suppress this rebellion, the Imam migrated from Medina with his governmental employees and his army in order to suppress the rebellion. There, after the rebellion was suppressed, he decided to move to Kufa, which was closer to that city, to keep an eye on it, and he just decided to stay there. There were certain reasons for this, which we would like to enumerate for our listeners here today. The first is the special geographical location of the city of Kufa. At the time of the establishment of Imam Ali's government, the Islamic world, as you know, its boundaries and its parameters had expanded a great deal, and it had stretched. This was due to the wars and the conquests that the caliphs who were prior to Imam Ali had undertaken. And so the boundaries of Islam, the Islamic world, stretched from Syria all the way westward and all the way eastward to other lands further past Iraq and these places, right? So at that time, the city of Kufa, because of this, had become located in the center of Islamic world. And Imam Ali, by placing the center of his government in the city of Kufa, he made himself accessible both to all places in the Islamic world equally, and also it gave him access to these places. He was equidistant for all these places, and it allowed him to keep watch over these different cities. No city was further away from him than any other city. This was one of the reasons why he decided to stay in Kufa. And this is also very important, keeping in mind another fact, and that is that at that time, Syria was under the control of Muawiyah, who was a staunch enemy of Imam Ali. So by staying in Kufa instead of Medina, the Imam was able to keep a watch over the ongoings of that city and also Muawiyah. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at why Imam Ali chose Kufa to be his capital and the center of his government. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I have the honor and privilege of being joined by my brothers in faith and humanity. To the right, I have the one and only brother Habib. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me here. It's always an honor and a pleasure. And to my right,
assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And thank you for having me, Abdullah al-Musawi.
Thank you so very much for joining us, gentlemen. Gentlemen, if you could just have a brief introduction of yourselves and your field of study, just for our listeners who've recently joined our program or those who've been with us for a really long time but have somehow forgotten.
Brother Habib, at your service. I'm studying in the Hausa. I've been studying for 10 years, Mashallah. Which is a long time for,
it is,
to some
to
extent.
To be studying anything, really.
Yeah, and...
And Brother Abdullah?
Well, I am in the same boat as Brother Habib. We kind of started together in Hausa. Maybe he was like a year before me.
I was a year before you.
Yeah. So we both students of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Children, children, children.
Be honest here.
You can't live with them. You can't live without them. Brother Habib, do you like kids?
Love them.
Okay.
Say my that. Kids.
Oh, your kids.
See, that's something that I learned after having kids.
That you love
and
them.
After my friends' kids.
Oh, so you felt that what you feel about your friends' kids is nothing compared to what you feel. Uh-huh.
Yes, and that's something to keep in mind when you go into divorce. Hopefully none of you guys go into divorce. That when you have kids and you fall into divorce, the stepfather or the stepmother that's going to come in and step in is going to see this child, even though they're very good, mm-hmm. even though they're top class, they're number one. This is not their biological
child.
I'd
make a great stepmom, but that's besides the point. Sid Abdullah, do you like kids?
I do.
To what extent do you actively like to be around them, or when they're there, you'll tolerate them in the best way you can?
No, I love them. Uh-huh. I like being around them. And
to play wrestling
I
with them.
Do tolerate them as well when they are being noisy.
Intolerable.
Intolerable. So all together, I like kids. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, I love to live and sit among kids. And I said to him, why? He said, because their hearts are pure.
Mm.
So yeah, generally speaking, I love kids. And I spend most of my life with kids, like either teaching them or...
Raising them.
Or,
right. How many kids do you have, if you don't mind me asking?
So far, 5.
MashaAllah. Brother Habib, you've got kids of your own. Obviously, your statement made it clear. So I guess you guys are definitely going to be against the whole campaign that has been going on across the world, especially in some regions more than others, against having children or having more than a few, like a restricted number of kids, right?
Yeah.
Why?
First of all, my personal view is that really, anyone that's not Muslim, to have less kids, it's a good thing for me. Because in a couple more years, they will find out that they have low population.
Mm. While the Muslim population is rapidly growing.
Yes. Mm. In another sense, for me, it's very important to have more kids. First of all, it's in our human nature. The love of, offspring, one of all. First of all, whether you want to deny it or not, your fitrah has a problem. It's not mine.
Mm-hmm.
Saving the humankind altogether. Humankind needs to reproduce remain. Otherwise, we'll go extinct. Thirdly, we're Shia. We're followers of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam.
Right.
And at the end of the day, our genes, our beliefs, our ideologies can be spread more by having more children. And whether you like this concept or not, every ideology, even atheists, have this kind of, centered in their mind, where human beings say that I have this idea, I have this concept, I want to spread it more. How do I spread it more? Bring on more people like me. And that is why raising your children is always on your shoulders. Bringing up your children the correct way is always correct. Now, you want to look at more like political, go ahead and look at the countries that are having problems with population. And the way that they are accepting refugees, the way that they are opening their doors for giving out citizenships to non-nationals, right? Mm. Why? Because they are seeing that they are having problems with bringing children. They had this fear in the 60s, if I'm not wrong, where they said that we're going to have an overpopulation and conception and everything and, all these
our
concepts,
resources
blah,
aren't
blah,
be
blah.
Enough,
yeah. And all these fake things that turned out to be wrong and not even that. Thing is that we might fall into low population in the coming 60 years. especially in countries who are affected, fell into this propaganda. Like, all right, have less kids, you'll save more money. They're bringing up these false advertisements. And as a Muslim, I personally believe the more children you have, the more rizq, the more wealth that comes with it. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've lived it. I've experienced it. Not only that, my parents experienced it. Not only my parents experienced it, my sister has experienced it. I've seen people up close where they didn't have, what's the lowest, like a dollar in their pocket. They didn't have a dollar in their pocket when their child came. But when they started to raise them and so on, the first couple of months, their wealth increased. And that's
to meet the needs of that new human
the fear of wealth and the fear of the needs of the child is something wrong. There are some people who claim that raising the child, you shouldn't have a lot of children. Why? Because raising the child is going to be hard. No, who says that? Teachers raise 30 and 40 children every day.
Yeah, that doesn't
there's some classes that doesn't make
it.
Sense.
Sayyid Abdullah, what do you think is the reason why people have been campaigning against having kids or more than a certain number of kids? Well, we understand it in countries such as China, which is now regretting it immensely. But why has this movement been happening in the past few decades?
There are a number of reasons to why this movement has been happening and growing rapidly. The reason that they have, whether I agree with them or not, is a different thing. But one is that people seek those who are against it. Number one, I mean, I'm talking statistically, if you go Google it, you see the number one reason people trying to not have kids is because they say, I am much happier.
Mm-hmm.
Is their own happiness, their own self-gratification. So they're just being selfish. I don't want to have kids. I want to be happy. Why should I bring another kid that was going to, I have to raise, I have to take care of, blah, blah, blah. I don't need that nonsense. I'm happy. So that's the number one reason people always have when it comes to not having babies. Two, I want to be free. I don't want any attachment. Three, people say, well, I got too old. Four, people say, well, I'm financially incapable. And the last thing people will say, oh, I have health issues. Now, wherever each human being has his own reason to why they should not have a baby. If you have a valid reason, by all means. If you don't want to have a baby, that's also your choice. It's not compulsory. It's not wajib. But it's like Brother Habib said, it's a human nature. And this statistically says that people, after they pass the age of 35, they will always have this regret of not having a child. Everyone goes through that process. The Prophet, he himself, he says, get married, have kids. On the Day of Judgment, I will use that as a point of pride for me, even the miscarriage babies. So there are emphasis Islamically on us bringing kids, not to mention the fact that, they will become a Hasana Jariyah or Sadaqa Jariyah, continuous charity for you and other benefits. But for those who don't want to have kids, obviously, like I said, we have to look at their reasons why and see, at the end of the day, I have to respect the opinion of people who don't want to have kids. But should you march and make a movement and try to convince people not to have kids?
But a lot of people who are, they are concerned with the fact that Earth's resources have been exhausted and there's global warming and there are so many children who are orphans and are victims of war and don't have parents and they need to be adopted at the end of the day. And why can't we open our arms to those kids who are in fact more in need rather than succumb to the biological need to reproduce and spread our own seed?
It goes back to this factor that that I stated at the beginning of the show, and that is that this is not your biological son or daughter. True, some people do tolerate them, but it's not like when you tolerate your biological son. And I've read so much about adopted children and how much problems they fall into by their, adopted families. Some families adopt them for they think that it's going to be good and everything is going to happen. It turns out to be wrong. Mm-hmm. Some people adopt for example, for financial reasons, because when you adopt, you get more, I don't know what do they call it, you know, finance from the government, or you gain more fame,
incentives.
You know, it's like for reasons they adopted them. All right, what does this have to do with us reproducing or not? All right, if I adopt or not, it doesn't matter. Why should I stop from reproducing? Yeah,
you can still adopt, and you can produce yourself.
It's a bad idea.
If you have the concept.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
What the argument that the sisters are bringing is that we're draining the resources of Earth. I think we're not. Earth have the power to sustain 10 billion people, if not more.
It had the power to sustain dinosaurs, for God's sake.
What's sucking the Earth resources are the greedy companies and the greed of man. We're running out of water. We're running out of trees because we have to make so much unnecessary things in our lives. I mean, do we really need all these things that we have now? We don't. What companies are doing, they're sucking the resources of Earth just so they could make money. That's what's happening. Stop these companies from producing this nonsense that we're living. Take phones, for example. How much phones and computers and PCs that we throw every 6 months just to replace is taking from the Earth resources.
For sure.
It's not us. It's not people that wants to have kids are killing. Land, as a matter of land, Earth is very fast and most of it is inhabitable. No one lives in it. It's either desert or forest. No one's living in it. So we can expand on Earth if we want. The problem is the companies, the greed of governments to kill Earth itself by what they're doing to it, not by people producing and having more kids. If I have more kids, my kids, what will they need? They need vegetables, which I can grow. They need clothes, which I can make. They don't need all this extra nonsense that the world is creating that is killing Earth. So that's what's coming.
So are you suggesting that we go back or adopt some sort of Amish lifestyle
No, we're not.
Don't be greedy.
Everything has a limit. Everything has a limit. Create the means of comfort for yourself. But I mean, if you look at your own house, how many things in the house that we have right now that we don't actually need? You know what I mean? We just need so much plastic things that we have, billions of plastic things we have, we just don't need. I have only in my house, there's over 500, plastic spoon packages that I get every time I make an order. It comes, I'm like, why would you send it to me? I don't need it. I got a spoon at home. You know what I mean? So we end up making all these little things. You have it, I have it, and millions of people, billions of people have it, and these companies must produce these things, and they end up affecting the environment. Yes, give us the necessary items that we need for our comfort, fridge, TV, and all the things that we need, but there are so many things that we don't need. You know what I mean? I'm saying we need to cut down on these things. And mankind, they have the capacity, and instead of saying, you know what, don't have kids, we say no. Try to all these things that cause pollution and cause global warming and cause these ones, stop them. Emission from cars, emission from companies, emission from this. These things that you need to stop.
I would say this. Don't let the conditions and the environments affect your Islamic lifestyle.
Yeah.
Then what they are arguing is that such a huge chunk of already existing growing communities are going through poverty. Why don't you take that money you'd want to spend on expansion to support these people?
Sister, build
more jobs, build more homes, build more hospitals.
Have you seen how much McDonald's spend yearly on slaughtering sheep? Have you seen all these chain food restaurants? Have you looked at NASA, how much NASA spends billions of dollars yearly, which it could end world hunger in an instant? Elon Musk himself, 3% of his wealth could end world hunger.
He did donate the money.
He did. So how many people we have, they could end all this and they could make the world a better place.
So why don't we focus on ending the issues and problems that we have at hand now? And then once everything is hunky-dory and rainbows and butterflies, we'll start reproducing all over again.
Because we're not going to have enough time doing that. Because everyone, when you're greedy, you're blind. You keep on going and walking. We're living in inflammation right now, whether we like it or not. Every country in the world, I'm not giving out any exceptions, right? Everyone is living in inflammation. Everyone's living on loans. Everyone's living on debts.
Yeah.
And you go back to the reality
of
the cash.
Earth doesn't have the resources we have. They make
it. We can make it. Allah gave us the power to. Have children, people, for God's sakes, especially Muslims. Well, not Muslims, you don't want Shia, to. That's your problem. Shia.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Afghanistan's tumultuous days have stretched on to complete over four decades. With the new Talib rulership, at least 1,000 a day have been fleeing across the country's porous border into Iran since last August. By now, there's no less than 4.5 million Afghans in Iran. This is while even the former statistic of under 3 million included only 600,000 legal Afghan immigrants. The security issue here is clear. There's millions of undocumented, unknown people in this country that is itself sanctioned by the US with a wealth of its own economic hardships. Now, safety issues are added, and some fear not just from common crime. After all, the Taliban were an armed guerrilla group that have become an inexperienced Afghan government of what it's calling the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. How Afghans are doing in Iran and what their changing demography will mean for them and for Iran, we will study today. Also, how stability can be secured in Afghanistan so that its people can return to safety, leaving behind an unchallenged Iranian border. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Both sides, Iran and Afghanistan, proclaim brotherhood, so to speak, and say whatever border issues were a misunderstanding or because of the Taliban being new to govern. This, of course, means there has been some tension at the border. And Iranian Parliament or Majlis did call in the Interior Minister, Ahmad Vahidi, for questioning, giving him a chance to probe further into the issue of border security. Mr. Maliki is an MP who served as ambassador to Afghanistan. He spoke of Parliament's probe into the border situation and his experience with ordinary Afghans during his posting to their country.
Following the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, one of the issues that the National Security Committee, the Parliament, and the Supreme National Security Council began to consider was the Taliban itself, their views, and the developments in this Muslim country, which shares a long history with Iran. It was a natural thing to do. We did so with regard to Pakistan and other countries in the region. But considering the fact that the Taliban came to power with a distinct ideology, the Islamic Republic of Iran was concerned about a possible incident taking place with Afghanistan, especially considering the sheer length of the border with this country.
Meshkini, spokesman for Iranian Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Commission, noted that the security situation along Iran's borders is great, given it has one of the most powerful border forces of the region. But all movements in those areas must be carefully monitored all the same. He stressed, the question is if the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan were aware of the movements. Mr. Rajoy is an Afghan affairs analyst. He made a trip to Press TV studios to share his views.
Speaking of Iran's policy on Afghanistan, Tehran's sole concern is security and sustainable peace in the country. But unfortunately, the situation in Afghanistan is intensifying every day. That's because of foreign interference. Proxy wars and excessive demands from some neighboring countries have prevented Afghanistan from achieving peace. Look at Afghanistan through the history since Najibullah, we can see that the people of Afghanistan have never experienced absolute peace of mind. There have been ethnic wars, wars between political and jihadi factions that intensified by the day. Genocide has been a reality both back then and right now. All Afghans have been targeted. We can't assume that any ethnicities in Afghanistan, either Pashtuns, Tajiks or Hazara, have been immune to this. They have all been dealing with problems that will result in even more disasters for them every day.
The main border crossing between Iran and Afghanistan was closed last Saturday, April the 23rd, following a brief clash between Iranian border guards and armed men who were said to be Taliban members. The clash happened after Iranian guards prevented the Taliban's local authorities in Afghanistan's Herat province from building a road on the border without coordination with Iranian authorities, IFP reports.
The presence of some Takfiri groups in Afghanistan raised fears. Over the past few weeks, we witnessed adventurism from certain groups on our borders. Our border patrol and army that's been stationed there responded to them. I recently paid a visit to the area and witnessed that. Although the Taliban said they didn't mean anything, the Iranian Foreign Ministry was tasked with contracting the Taliban and addressing the issue to ensure it won't happen again.
Considering water and the right to access the water, they play new tricks every day. They blow hot and cold about giving Iran access and recognizing Iran's right to the waters. We care for the people of Afghanistan more than the water issue. We care about the security of our people, which will be affected by them in the not-so-distant future. If we can't manage the issue, which, by the way, we haven't so far, we'll definitely have to pay for it. We've dealt with the problems from a humanitarian perspective. There have been clashes in the meanwhile. The border clashes have been intentional and we shouldn't forget them that easily. The video clips and remarks that are being propagated indicate an open animosity. When they kill Shias, they're trying to appease certain groups. They kill people and mourn for them too.
Afghanistan has been thunderstruck. First came the Soviet invasion of 1978 and a Russian military presence going on some 15 years till 1992, years of fighting with Taliban. Less than a decade since, in 2001, the 9/11 Twin Tower explosion served as a pretext for America to attack Afghanistan. That presence went on for 20 years with a division of power with the Taliban. With a U.S. withdrawal finalized end August 2021, the Taliban became the sole rulers of Afghanistan. But they're new. They don't appear to have established a single unified policy, and they are yet to be internationally recognized. Iran won't recognize them unless they include all ethnicities. For the people of Afghanistan, it says, as well as its own security. A Talib Pashtun government alone sounds like it will be less brotherly to Iran than one that includes the Tajiks and Hazaras. The Tajiks speak Tajiki Persian, and Hazaras speak Hazaragi, a dialect of Persian, Persian being the official language of Iran or Persia. For many Afghans, a return home is a dream long lost. They see no choice but to cross over into Iran over a treacherous borderland of over 920 kilometers. The average refugee settles for low-paid, unskilled labor. But there's more than exceptions to the rule. Our trip to slushy suburbs south of Tehran didn't appear inspiring, and so it came as a pleasant surprise to find a wooden furniture factory bazaar on one slushy wide dead end. With several mostly Afghan lads putting his furniture together, the bulk of goods in the making tell of one Mr. Yusefi's success story.
I came to this country in 1994. I was in the construction business until around 2003. Then I started working for a company that specialized in this. That's how I got familiar with this job. It was around 2007 that we got a small workshop that was around 80 square meters where we provided various services. For example, we'd paint chairs for a fee. We continued the job and expanded the business to its current size.
The self-fashioned entrepreneur showed me around his two workshops, one for carpentry, the other for finishing, as well as his exhibition warehouse. He was using all grades of wood, but focusing on affordable raw material with a better finish. It's a modest income, he explained, in spite of the bulk of work and production. But I noticed about 12 people in his employ at the time for what he called regular wages.
I used to work in the construction business. We used to build street curbs and other physically demanding jobs at very low costs. This is a service in itself. As a foreign national, I may be forced to accept 800,000 tomans for a chair, but an Iranian colleague and neighbor of mine wouldn't accept a job at that amount. I'll take very slim profit margins to let the wheels spin. Our growth has been weaker compared to our Iranian counterparts, but we've worked hard for it. I started work at 8 a.m. and finish at 10 p.m. With such dedication, you'll eventually grow.
Earlier in the day, that's closer to the Taliban takeover, 4,000 to 5,000 were reported to be making their way in from Afghanistan, negotiating dangerous routes for $500 to $600 per head with smugglers. Not everyone pays that much, but it's never a comfortable trip at times in car trunks into any city they can get to. Mr. Abedi is an expert on the matter. He joined us on Skype. Do listen in.
The most important opportunity Iran has provided for immigrants is their security. Unfortunately, security is a big regional issue, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. Three countries with the most immigrants to Iran, which have imposed a heavy economic burden on the country. They enjoy such security that they engage in economic activities. Afghans especially have a remarkable presence in Iran's economic activities. So do Iraqis.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Today, nearly 6 million Afghans have been driven out of their homes and their country by conflict, violence, and poverty, according to UN refugees. What's noticeable about Iran is that while 4% of refugees live in 20 settlements managed by the Interior Ministry's Bureau for Aliens and Foreign Immigrants Affairs, BAFIA, refugee populations are generally protracted here. That's to say, 96% of refugees live scattered among Iranians, in cities, towns, and villages. What's also noteworthy is that children can now receive nationality even from an Iranian mother. That's not something you see everywhere in the world. Iran's is one of the longest and most protracted refugee situations in the world, beginning in 1979 due to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
The point is that granting citizenship can impose various costs on a country, as a large number of people would be added to the population, which needs facilities, services, in budget and might even create security concerns for the country. But all in all, the Iranian society has been accepting the migrants because we see most of the migrants as our brothers and sisters, including the Afghans and Iraqis.
Going by government figures, in October 2020, there were 800,000 registered refugees living in Iran, 780,000 of them Afghan and 20,000 Iraqi. Additionally, nearly 600,000 Afghan passport holders live in this country. Refugees are given access to education, health, and livelihood opportunities. The idea is to help them thrive, not just survive. And back in 2015, Iran passed the law allowing all Afghan children, be they passport holders or undocumented, to attend public schools. Based on 2020 figures provided by the Education Ministry, Iran offered free education to about 560,000 foreign students, the majority of them Afghans. Although no good deed goes unpunished if not practiced with care,
if we want to get to the bottom of the problem, we need to acknowledge that part of the challenges is posed by refugees and the other by migrants and fighters. Killing is part of the Taliban's ideology. They are openly working on it and it's dangerous. They don't send their fighters here for holidays. You saw what happened in Mashhad, but because of certain considerations, they didn't publicize it that much. It was a problem anyway. Their activities on the border are problematic and serious. Their setting fire to Iran's missions poses a serious threat. Their protests outside our embassy in Kabul are a serious development. The Taliban in the past have made moves that run contrary to our interests.
For the past 20 years, displacement has followed US and NATO wars in West Asia. But the West doesn't appear inclined to take responsibility. Western humanitarian bodies have called on their governments to step up, though. There's more coming up, namely on the general Western attitude toward the refugee situation in this region. But that's only after a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. And here's how it's panned on the page. Iran to register all Afghan refugees is the headline run by IFP, Iran front page. Iran's Interior Minister Ahmad Vahidi says all Afghan refugees in the country will be identified and registered. He stated one of the serious problems for Afghan nationals entering Iran is their identification, adding that not knowing the exact number of refugees and their location is hindering efforts to help them. After the catastrophes that the United States caused in Afghanistan and the many problems it created for the people of this country, and after the formation of the new government, we faced an influx of Afghan refugees coming to the borders of our country, Vahidi explained. The people of Afghanistan have faced many difficulties. Some of them were forced to come to the borders of Iran out of fear and viewed the Islamic Republic as a safe place. On the other hand, some of the Afghan people became financially broke and saw all their assets lost. And we faced a large wave of Afghan people moving to the borders of Iran, he added. Mehr News reads, Iran ready to medically assist the injured in Afghanistan blasts. The Iranian health minister, Bahram Einollahi, said all Afghan refugees residing in Iran have benefited from the free vaccination program. Einollahi condemned the recent deadly terrorist attacks in Mazar-e-Sharif's mosque and the students of Shahid Abdurrahim School in Kabul and Afghanistan and said the enemies of both Iranian and Afghan nations seek to divide the two nations by committing such heinous crimes during the holy month of Ramadan. He said the health ministry is ready for any humanitarian health care assistance to the people of friendly and brotherly country Afghanistan. The minister added the Iranian health ministry, based on humanitarian grounds and within the framework of the Islamic Republic of Iran's policies, spared no efforts to help the Afghan refugees residing in this country. Taslim News has run the headline, Iran hosted Afghan refugees even under sanctions. That's true, that's even without international assistance that usually comes with hosting refugees. This is what the government spokesperson Bahodori Jahromi tweeted. While the UK, claiming human rights advocacy, wants to send refugees to Rwanda, Iran has hosted Afghan refugees and immigrants for years, even under sanctions, without the usual international assistance. On Thursday, April the 28th, the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced all refugees arriving in the UK in boats will be sent to Rwanda. If their application is successful, They will not be given refugee status in the UK, but will be granted asylum by Rwanda. Those unsuccessful could be deported back to their country of origin or any other country they have a right to reside in. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh